morning, Gloucester.
Good morning.
It is GloucesterCast 382. We are banging them out at a rapid pace. And we have one of our esteemed guests. We are honored to have Ron Gilson with us today. The foremost, utmost, number one Gloucester historian.
Wow.
The guy that tells it like it is and doesn't bloviate with fairy tale stories. He takes you down memory lane in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and he tells the story, and you can feel the feels, you smell the smells, you hear the sounds of exactly the way it was, not some romanticized version of the way it was in Gloucester, Massachusetts, back in the glory days.
That's quite a build-up.
That's a build-up and a half, isn't it?
Do we not feel that way?
We do feel that way.
Ron Gilson, also the author of the best book about the heyday of Gloucester fishing industry and the island no more, that you can get at the bookstore of Gloucester.
And just the day before, I restocked the bookstore.
Oh, good.
And they're still there. I'm happy to report they're still
selling
my book.
Yeah.
After 7 or 8 years or whatever.
Well deserved.
Everybody that reads it loves it.
Yes, absolutely.
Anyway. Yeah. So Ron Gilson is with us. Jimmy and Pat are here with me.
Good morning, Gloucester.
I know. Good morning. We have so many people not here. Chris is on traveling all over the place. So on behalf of Chris, happy birthday, Joey. Ralphie isn't here. I think he's still on vacation. So
what else is though?
He loses out on here. Kim is running around. Kim has so many errands running around doing some things too with so many family things going on and all this stuff going too. So just us.
Yep.
Pat Dalpiaz is on the keyboard.
Morning.
So if you have any questions.
Trying to keep up here.
Trying to keep
with
up.
With everybody being so interested, which is great.
Yeah. So we have a two-way camera. I'm going to switch it over to a one-way just on our esteemed guest. Oh, actually, we have some topics. So I'm going to bring in some of our topics here that we were talking about. Oh, here they are. Put this over here. Sorry about that, guys.
Can I inject a little something here?
Yes, of course. How did it go? We did it was the first day at the senior center after having after having your big promo.
Well, I'm happy to report. I've been to about 3 or 4 sessions, and there's about 3 or 4 in the audience, and this 10-piece band is knocking themselves out, and it's great music, and I'm looking around, and I'm saying there's no one to dance with. Well, they play normally the first 3 Mondays of the month. Last Monday, a couple of days ago, Joni announced to me that she was home for the day and not playing bridge, so she wanted to go, so boom, I had a partner to dance with. Well,
we got there,
and thanks to the publicity through Good Morning Gloucester and your announcement, we normally, as I said, had 5 or 6. This past Monday, we passed a sheet around, and there were 26 people that signed
boom.
Up.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to get you all excited.
It
can't always, it's not always Good Morning Gloucester, but certainly they must have had something to do with it. Anyway.
So
the band was great.
First 3 Mondays of it, so just to reiterate, at the Rose Baker Center, first 3 Mondays, from what time to what time?
1 to 3.
1 to 3.
And next Monday, though, there's a Valentine's party, and you're all invited.
Okay.
Even if you aren't a senior. but you're invited. And
what, the hair gave it away? Or what?
You have to sign in. But anyway. So I was going to skip next Monday, but the 3rd Monday of the month, the band will be back. So we had a great time, and I got to dance with my wife a couple of times.
Oh, how nice.
And then, the band played some crazy music, and the 3 women got out. And I jumped up, and we did the hoochie coochie for about. The music went on, and finally, I was happy to sit down. Well, the next day, Tuesday... yesterday, I went in, And the gal that monitors that whole thing, she said to me, the first thing, she says, how are you feeling today? Well, to tell you the truth, I went to bed early Monday night. Anyway, it's showing signs of a little revival, and it should be good in the future. But it's a great thing, and if you have nothing to do on a Monday, come on down. We'd love to have you.
There you go. Thank you for that, Ron. Super Bowl was this past Sunday, and we had a hell of a time.
We did.
And so we have a question for our viewership. We had a little bit of a... Everybody was bringing food. So Chris McCarthy made ribs, barbecue ribs.
They were awesome.
They were amazing. My sister Felicia made pretzels, you know, the big pretzels that you dip in the mustard and stuff like that. I made chili. Kate made a barbecue chicken in a dough, kind of a cut up.
Almost like a stromboli kind of.
Like a stromboli thing. And Pat rolls in with a quiche.
Two
quiches.
Two quiches,
a vegetable quiche and a meat quiche.
This is all dangerous food you're describing. I was in the business.
Super Bowl Sunday. So here's the thing. You ever hear that saying, real men don't eat quiche?
Yeah.
This is what I want from Pat. I want to understand what the thought process was when you decided to bring quiche to a Super Bowl party.
I did give this an awful lot of thought.
Oh, so this was premeditated.
It was premeditated.
So which makes the offense even worse.
And I'll say that when we left, there was one single slice taken out of the meat quiche, and
a full one of the veggies. No one touched it. It was the loneliest dish.
It was a very lonely looking.
An enormous island.
It had a pride of place too on the island.
Yeah,
Charlene did a great job
it was
placing
right
it.
Right in the middle, you had to pass the quiche to get to anything else. And at the end of the night, 11 o'clock at night, the quiche was and I found this out. There was only one piece of quiche taken, and it was by McCarthy, who said he felt bad for Pat, and that's the only reason he even tried the quiche.
God bless my friend.
Can I ask where this soiree all took care of?
This is at McCarthy's house. McCarthy's new digs in East Gloucester. So, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about trying to come up with something a little bit different, and I was also thinking about all the people that weren't going to necessarily be paying all that much attention to the football game. That's something that might please them.
But, oh, so you went with a contrarian kind of a pick.
Yes, which
so is, you said all these guys and all these football fans are gonna be thinking about like regular football food, which you would think of. So I'm gonna go outside of the box and get something for the women that hate football.
Nothing that I can do is ever gonna be able to compete with Kate and Felicia and Craig and all these wonderful offerings all these wonderful offerings that are available, even if it is an eggplant pizza that was supposed to be a cheese pizza.
Oh my God. Suzanne was having a meltdown.
If you were expecting an eggplant pizza Super Bowl Sunday and you got a cheese pizza instead, I'm very sorry.
The look on her face when they opened up the pizza
box.
Because they ordered a cheese pizza and they opened it up and it was like an eggplant pizza.
Yeah.
The look on her face, I would not want to be the person that made the mistake that handed her the eggplant pizza, because she would have stabbed the guy right in the face.
I feel pretty bad for whoever was supposed to have that, because I'm sure they had their mouth set and ready for it, and that's not what they got.
Well, I felt bad, you know, for Mick too, because he even said when he saw her look and he looked at the pizza, he kind of said very plainly, I didn't look. I was told to pick it up. I did.
Yeah. I didn't, yeah. So I don't know.
I've been there, done that.
I guess quiche is not, I understand now that quiche is not Super Bowl party football food. I'll have to reserve that for a brunch or for,
well, you're definitely under the microscope from here on out.
Yeah, well, one microscope at least, apparently.
Not everybody was talking about it.
Yeah, well, why?
Well, why? I can't imagine why, because as soon as we walked in and you were very excited to see us bringing two big boxes in, And when we opened it up, you just let everyone know right there, what in the hell is this? Is exactly if the case from
our,
you.
If you're in our group and you don't understand that there is a chance to get your balls broken and you don't expect to get your balls broken,
that's true.
Then
yes.
You're in the wrong group.
Yes. Is that right? I will say I was in a weakened state. Not on the top of my game.
So you came,
last week.
You had the flu and you came over anyways to so
yeah.
So listen to this one. So there's a whole thing with if every year recently, and I don't remember earlier, but the teachers will send notices home. If your child has the flu, do not send them to school. Mm. We don't want them because it's just that's how it spreads, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people that have kids and they have jobs and they have to go to the jobs. So where there is some type of and there's hardships.
It's a tough.
There's
thing.
Definitely hardships. Yeah. So I'm not passing judgment. I'm just saying, a lot of kids end up going to school on like when it's wishy washy, because it's tough to have an out for them to.
It isn't always built. They don't have built-in care.
Right, exactly. But you apparently had.
Well, I wasn't contagious.
We didn't need built-in care for you, but you decided to come and spread your germs anyway.
No, I wouldn't have come if I had thought I was contagious, but I did not. I was not at the top. In fact, it was only this morning that I woke up and said, you know what, I feel a lot more like myself. It's been about 2 weeks.
And what did I tell you when you walked in? When you said
you said, good morning, sunshine. I'm so glad you're here. Isn't that you?
No, what else I said was, when you said you were feeling better, I says, it must be that you ate the leftover quiche.
Which we did have for dinner last night.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was yummy.
I have to say, I have tried that quiche before.
And it is very good.
It's excellent quiche. Not so much football food.
Not football food. I'll grant you that.
Well, I just want to close out by saying, you know, Charlene, Chris, another wonderful experience at your house. You basically just moved in there and you open up for so many people to see games.
Hey,
it was great. And
got introduced to a new Irish whiskey.
Redbreast 12,
I think it was. Chris allowed me a little portion of his stash.
They have this
really
gorgeous
pantry. It's beautiful.
Yes.
This beautiful pantry. Right out, their kitchen is gorgeous to begin with. And then the pantry is wide open, which is dangerous because they have some pretty good top shelf booze.
They do.
So last week when we were there, I pulled off the shelf a bottle of the Buffalo Trace.
Yes.
And I was a little tipsy at the time. And I started pouring the Buffalo Trace bourbon. It's bourbon that I love. To everyone. And the next morning I thought about it. And I thought that might have been the rudest thing that I have done in a long time. Just grabbing someone's nice bottle. And I told them that I would replace it. Because I thought that was really bad form to go into someone's liquor cabinet and pull out a bottle. So I am replacing his bottle of bourbon. Ralph is checking in from Barbados. And they look like they're having a hell of a trip.
Hi, Ralph.
How you doing, Ralphie? Give us the update on the weather over there. We have a couple things that we want to talk about. Mom's Kitchen, our sponsors, who we're looking forward to getting back in the good, get their food coming back here. We've been missing them. Next Monday, February 10th at 5:30 a.m., they'll be back on, according to their information.
Yeah, their website.
They'll be reopened for breakfast and lunches. And
in their new digs across the street.
In their new digs. So they're right there on the cusp. Duckworth Bistro has renovated. It's been a while, and I haven't seen it yet. Kim Smith went there either yesterday or this morning to take photos.
Take some pictures.
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, we'll be seeing that.
So there's that.
Just in time for Valentine's Day.
Just in time for Valentine's Day. That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a great point. You know what? Maybe I should make my reservation.
Maybe it's time to make your reservation.
That's a great idea. Yeah, because I get back that night. So there's that. Pat had a topic, and the topic is herding and flocking. I don't know what this is about, but Pat has this topic. Herding and flocking.
Yes, and it goes along with that contrarian behavior that you noted earlier, I think, because
okay.
I've noticed that my beloved husband, Jim, has a tendency, and I have only mentioned it to him a couple of times in passing, whereby...
You're on the carpet.
I know.
As an example, we went to the Azorian for lunch recently, and there was one other car in the parking lot, and he parked next to it.
Oh.
This is very typical behavior.
Okay.
If we go to a movie theater, he wants to sit near the other two people that are seated
at the... Could there be a wide-open beach, and he'd lay his
yes.
towel within 5 feet of
absolutely.
Another person?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So, okay.
So I've been studying this.
That's called... Okay. And
so go ahead.
Right, wait.
Well, I have to
change the camera over here.
Okay.
So Jim gets a rebuttal, and I have to hear this rebuttal.
Yeah.
Because this is beyond.
You think the key should.
This is absolutely beyond my comprehension. That why in the world in an open parking lot would you park directly next to another car? As I know that you are an incredible car buff. You cherish your cars. You take care of your cars.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you park that next to a car where you could get your car door opened on your car? So,
well, wait now. Okay. Let me explain a little bit about my thinking process in
okay.
studying this, because I was like, surely this is some sort of social behavior phenomenon that I need to know about, because, and I thought it had something to do with how social Jim is. Jim is a very social
Absolutely.
Creature,
yeah.
and he loves to be in the middle of what is going on. I am less social than Jim is, and I'm the little baby gazelle going off away from the herd when there's a cheetah lurking in the...
I wonder if this is a man or woman thing, because
maybe.
I'm more like Jim, and I like to be with friends, you know, around people, and given my druthers, I am with a group of people hanging out.
Right.
Talking.
But apparently it can be called herding or it can be flocking. And it is the tendency of humans to want to stay in groups for safety.
Okay. All right.
To be in the safety of a group against predators.
Oh, okay. All right, so we're gonna throw it to Jim now and mm-hmm. hear his explanation.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm glad she's back and feeling so much better. because, you know, it's important to know that
She's
feeling better.
Game. Yeah,
yeah,
right,
if
right.
If you have
right.
seen her days, none of this would have happened. You know, she would never bring any of this up. Okay. It's one of those situations. I can't recall every little thing, but I can say with the parking, since you brought up the parking, when I'm pulling in, sometimes she wants to be closer to a door for that quick exit. I don't know if you call it the Irish getaway or whatever you want to call it.
That's a different topic.
Okay. She likes to be near a certain thing. She doesn't like to walk very far, where I would go park at something convenient for the car. I'll walk a little bit. No, we should be closer. So I guess I may go overboard and go a little bit too much that I pull up closer to a door, even though somebody else, probably a guy that did it too, parked closer to the door for somebody else. Yeah, I guess I go over there.
Also, follow the vehicles through the easy pass lane. Don't go through the empty easy pass
right.
lane. We
right.
follow the other vehicles that are going through the other easy pass lane.
Yes.
He's definitely herding and flocking.
Yes.
There's no question.
When you're traveling along and there's two or three easy passes, and the first one is the one everyone's going through and there's all the others, yep, I'll go in the first one, because when you're over in the third one, they come out and you're trying to merge and the big truck's coming. So I'll stay in the first one so I can control the situation. So in my defense, I want to control the situation and I'll go in the first one. So we've talked about that. Now, as far as the beach and the blanket and everything, I wouldn't be like that. Okay. I wouldn't be right on top.
That's a pet peeve for, especially
in
Gloucester, there's a lot of people that can identify with people that the people that do that is considered an absolute no-no, and it freaks me out.
No,
it's not just in Gloucester. It's like any beach community. You go to the beach and you lay down a towel, and if someone comes on that, and there's no one within 20 yards of you, and someone comes down and lays down their towel right next to you, like 5 feet away. Right.
In the movie theater, I'll move if that happens.
Will you really move?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because it's just that irritating.
Now, Joey, when we went to the movie theater, we all went. I just followed. I didn't suggest that we should go to a certain place.
Well, it was interesting. So Kate and I went to see a movie at the Liberty Tree Mall, that mm-hmm. movie theater. And it's been so long that I went to the movies that I did not realize that they have a screen and you pick out your seat from the screen.
Yes. Yes.
Which is like, well, now all of a sudden you're like, well, I got to be in the middle because I want the square on view, and I want to mm-hmm. be right kind of in the middle, top to bottom, so I'm looking at it straight on. Mm-hmm. So you kind of like, you see the chart of what the seats that are taken, and that actually makes you cluster because you're like,
true.
I'm not staying way off the sides right there.
That's true.
It used to be just first come, first serve, and now
it's
like very, I'd hate to like be there, come in late, and you absolutely know you're going to be way off in the wing there or looking straight up. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess my training with the teaching and all the music and being around the kids and the coaching, you just kind of think that we all need to go this way and just kind of follow it. And I'm firmly admitting that I don't take the right road all the time, but I try to make chicken salad out of chicken shit, and
it's not easy.
Not easy to do.
I do think your social ability does play in here, even if the psychologists don't seem to think so.
Well, there you go.
So anybody that wants to write, and do we have any comments about any of that?
I'm not seeing any comments on that. Everybody's hiding.
I just wanted to talk about just earlier this morning we had. We had Tim Sanborn from Cazalt Solar come in. And I'm always hammering because I'm such a fan of what they do and how Kate and I, our program has worked out for us. Whenever I post screenshots of my electric national grid bill with the credit on it, there's always, it seems to be, and I understand the skepticism from people questioning, well, yeah, but what are the costs, you know, that are associated with that. So we actually had Tim come in with dollar amounts and breaking down the whole structure of how it works and how quickly you get paid back and how much money you can actually make, all laid out.
It was all laid out very nicely.
Yeah, very. Didn't really go any far off the path to lose people.
Right.
And if you just like go through that, you will understand. And the way he explained it was dead on. So shout out to that.
Always does a great job.
He does a great job. I put a link in the show notes. So now we're at the point of the program where we're going to go and the star of the show, Ron Gilson, is going to have his segment because we have really gotten some tremendous feedback. And I have to mention that Brenda Grimes just commented, thank you for the card. I don't know what you did there, but she said thank you for the card.
She's one of my favorite people, with or without the blog.
Well, there you go. That's very nice to hear. So, Ron, today we're going to talk about Gloucester's former glory as a working waterfront.
Good.
And you had a few stories to tell.
Okay. When I walk down Main Street or down Center Street and I see an occasional sign with a finger pointing and it says, to the working waterfront, I kind of cringe when I see that because I look down on Sunday mornings from Angle Street into Harbor Cove and it's empty. Harbor Cove, that's where the Cape Horn Ice Company is and the Gloucester House Restaurant and other businesses are located. Harbor Cove is empty. There's not a vessel in sight. The North Channel that goes down by Captain Cowles and on down to the Fish Pier, that's the North Channel. And that's pretty empty too. So I just wonder if the people of today, when they read that sign, that's what they see as a working waterfront. If that's really the case, and I'll tell you right now, it's only a fraction of what we enjoyed, what we had, and what I experienced in 1945.
Now, I feel like I need to say this. The amount, those glory days were glorious, and there was so much activity, and it fed the whole city, because there's so many people that were either fishermen, fish packers, or service industry people that serviced the fishing industry. But what I'd like to point out is the amount of fish that was being pulled out of the ocean in those glory days, we can never go back to that. And the reason for that is it has been proved to be a completely unsustainable amount of fish being pulled out. So if we think that we can go back to having that many fish workers, that many boats, that much effort being placed on the stocks is absolutely disingenuous, because it actually got us where we are now, and because of the technology has gotten so great. So that being said, it was a special period of time that cannot be duplicated.
Right. But it's interesting, because now that you mention that, I also have a blog that I call The Gloucester I Love, too, and in that I talk about the fishing business and the demise, as Joey says, and I got a comment from somebody who said, well, wait a minute, what goes around comes around. That could all happen again. And, you know, I didn't answer that person, but it's not going to happen again. It can never happen again. For more than just one reason. It's not just the resource that's been fished out, if you will. But the customer, the clientele, the public have changed in their desires and their wants. You have to understand that when we were bringing in 2 million pounds of redfish a day, and 500,000 pounds of whiting or whatever, those fish were being sold for 3 and 4 cents a pound. You know, as a big stock, a big gross stock for any fishing vessel was $10,000. It was an unbelievable thing. And we were marketing millions and millions of pounds of fish. Now, that just can't happen again, because we don't have a market for cheap fish. People are sophisticated. The customer has changed. They no longer want salt fish in a box with a canned mackerel boiled in a vat down at Davis Brothers, thousands of pounds of mackerel. Open the can up 6 months later and it's enough to drive you. Anyway, so the market has changed, the public has changed, the housewife demands something, microwave products and so forth. So all those factors combined, along with the diminished stocks. And we could see it even in my day, in 1945 and 50, we fished right close by, and we had a redfish market right here in Gloucester, and that moved to Caches and further down to Browns and finally to the Grand Banks. The earlier banks, redfish had buttons in them, which are parasites about the size of a dime. The women sat at candling tables with lights under the table, and they, with clippers, clipped out those buttons, parasites. We moved from that quality of fish a little further. The fish got a little bigger, and we fished that out, and we went further down off in the Gulf of Maine, and then finally into Nova Scotia, and then on to the Grand Banks. All the time the fish were getting larger and larger, but they were also getting fished out. But aside from that, let's talk about the working waterfront, because anything that we have today does not even resemble what we experienced in 1945. First of all, the Gloucester Fisheries Association, in its heyday, listed in various periodicals, memberships of upwards of 23 companies, 23 cutting houses around the periphery of the harbor. General Seafoods in Harbor Cove was the largest, but there was also Cape Ann Fisheries, and there was Gardens of Gloucester. Those were the big kingpins, but there were 20-odd other companies all spaced around the waterfront that all processed redfish. Now, a redfish, for most people, weighs about a pound. We'll say it weighs a pound. The rate of recovery on a redfish is a good rate, is about 35 to 36%. In other words, there are two fillets, one on each side of the fish. Those two fillets represent a third of the fish. The head, the tail, the napes, the backbone, the guts, that's waste. That represents two-thirds of a redfish. So if there's 1 million pounds of redfish landed in one day, there's 35% recovery. The other 65% has to be dealt with. In my day, in 1945, there were two dehydrating process companies on the Gloucester Fish Pier that worked 24/7 in season. There was a third dehydrating process plant owned by Gartens of Gloucester, which was a small plant, and the excess, they had a barge tied to the wharf, and once or twice a week, depending on the volume for the week, that barge took the refuse of redfish out beyond the breakwater and dumped it. Any excess redfish that couldn't be handled by Ryan's dehydrating process, which I worked at for five seasons, that excess redfish product was taken to their plant in Woburn, Mass. So, aside from the third recovery rate of a redfish, two-thirds of it had to be ground up and dealt with, and where they made products like oil, a product called solubles, which is like a fish soup, if you will, and there was fish meal. And those products were all made finished at the fish pier in the dehydrating process company owned by John Ryan and the Gloucester Byproducts owned by Empire Fish Company and Cape Ann Fish Company and a couple other companies. They use the Gloucester Byproducts to take care of their excess or their we call it dairy. So, and then those plants to keep them going were also supplemented by the hoagie industry. So, all in all, we had 20-odd filling houses around the harbor. We had 200 vessels. Most of them were offshore, but there were certainly 50 or 60 boats operating mostly in Harbor Cove that were associated with the Gloucester Whiting Association. They were the inshore fleet. We had at least 20 seiners, that's mackerel fishing vessels, 20 seiners at least, conservatively. And they all carried a crew of 16 men. That's a normal complement. So the 16 men, that's 320 fishermen on seiners alone. The seining season would start in March and go all the way until September, we'll say. And shortly after January, all around the harbor and any building that had a big floor space, the seines were laid out. They were hung and getting ready. The crews were all there working. I will say working for free, if you will. They weren't paid. But in anticipation of leaving in March, 1st of April, for the southern shore, starting in Virginia and working their way up, catching mackerel along the coast until the warmer weather came. And in June, as I was walking to grammar school, I'd hear the first morning, I'd hear the putt, putt, putt of the engines, the donkey engines, and we knew that the first mackerel of the season were being landed. And then from then on, the rest of the summer into the fall, mackerel were being landed in Gloucester. But it all started for the men around March or April. And in January, they were prepping for this. So we had six machine shops in the city of Gloucester, six machine shops that serviced the over 200 vessels, their machinery. Those six machine shops were at the Beacon Marine Basin or Robinson's Marine Basin or Alexander's Beacon Marine Basin today. That's operated originally by William A. Robinson, as I talked about it the other day. And then came Gorton's of Gloucester. Gorton's of Gloucester's machine shop was the biggest machine shop in the city. It's right square where Cruiseport is today. And it was a large, vast area. And it was a fascinating place as a little boy because everything was powered by belts and paraphernalia overhead. That's how they drove the lathes, the drill presses, and so forth. And it was a busy place. The machinists, shafts being milled and bearings being worked on and so forth. It was a fascinating place. And a good friend of mine was a man by the name of Tony Alves, great guy. He lived up on Perkins Street, and he ran the parts department. And Gordon's, of course, was also the agent for the Atlas Imperial Marine Diesel, and that was an engine of choice in those days for most of the fleet. I'd say probably 40% of the fleet was powered by Atlas engines. So Tony Alves was a busy guy in the parts department, and which was adjacent to the machine shop. So we have Beacon Marine Basin, a machine shop. Gorton's of Gloucester had their own machine shop. Then we had Stoddard's machine shop on a place called Stoddard Way, which is off of Main Street, just up from, just down from the diner. And on the same side of the street, there's a little lane that goes up in there, and there's a building. Stoddard's was Stoddard's machine shop, and my grandfather worked and retired from there as a machinist. That's three. Then down on what we now call Harbor Loop, but was then Wharf Street, we had the Independent Machine Shop, which was operated by a man by the name of McKinnon. And my uncle John Sticklin worked there as a machinist. In back of that was Gloucester Machine Shop, which was owned by the Shores family from East Gloucester, and their son-in-law owned and operated that machine shop. And that shop took care of most of the gillnet fleet from the East Gloucester, the Shores, and the
Michigan Bears.
What's that?
They called them the Michigan Bears.
Yes, the gillneters, yes, okay. Well, there were Tizers, the Shores, the Warrels, the Arnolds, the Michigan Bears. They all came to Gloucester from Michigan. And when there was a lull in the fisheries in the Great Lakes, they brought their boats over the road and so forth. That's another story. But anyway, so, and then the sixth machine shop was on John J. Burke's Wharf, which was a busy, busy place. And that in itself is a story. That machine shop was operated by a friend of mine and a boat owner also. His family... His father was Nelson Amiro, I believe. It was Nelson Amiro who had the Doris F. Amiro built, and she tied up at John J. Burke's wharf complex. And Barney Amiro, or Bernard, but we called him Barney, who was a master mechanic. He had a machine shop that serviced mostly all of the fleet John J. Burke's facility service. And Barney Amiro was a six machine shop, and it took six machine shops to service the fleet of vessels we had at the time. And it was just a busy place. And as a little kid, an aside, a friend of mine is a man by the name of Eric Ronberg. He's now the curator of the marine curator at the Cape Ann Museum. Eric is a wonderful guy and a very talented model builder. He builds models that are in the Smithsonian Institute. He takes commissions for hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're first-class model builder. Well, anyway, Eric is now the curator of the KPN Museum. His father, Eric Romberg Sr., was a master rigger. And he's a Swedish man, I believe, and he goes back to the Merchant Marine in Sweden, and he learned how to splice and all that business. So he became a rigger, and he had a rigging shop next to Barney Amiro's machine shop on John J. Burke's Wharf. Well, Eric, Eric's father was just a real gentleman, just a nice man, very kind and considered. There were some wonderful people, and that's another story I want to touch on. There were some wonderful people working on the waterfront. Eric Ronberg's father was one of them. Well, Eric Ronberg was a little boy, 3 or 4 years old, and I was am about 10 years older. I was probably 12 or 14, and Eric's father asked me if I would babysit or watch his son while he worked on a vessel tied in front of the wharf complex. The vessel was a vessel by the name of the Bright Star. It's about a 75, 80-foot vessel, a beautiful thing built at the James Shipyard by James's son-in-law, Fred Head. It was the last vessel that was launched from the James Shipyard in 1947. And thank you. And Eric's father was the rigger, and he rigged all the wires and the ladders and all the rigging that is associated with a scallop. She was a scallop vessel. And I was the babysitter for young Eric, and I remind him to this day when I talk to him, I have a great picture of Eric, and I say, you know, I was your babysitter. You remember that? Well, he's just a real, real number one guy, and we're friends to this day. I want to just tell you one little story here. I can't be certain of the time, but about, we'll say, 10 years ago, Eric called me, and he said, Ron, I have a commission to build a vessel, and he's talking about a model now. He says, I have a commission to build a vessel, and I'd like to ask you a few questions if you're familiar with the vessel. And I said, well, which one is that? I'm ahead of my story. He called me and he said he had a commission to build a vessel, and did I have a suggestion as to what vessel was probably the most important vessel built in the 1940s in the Essex shipyard of Dana Story? And I thought a minute and I said, yes, I do. I have an excellent example that you could build, and the name of that vessel is the Kingfisher. And he said, oh, the Kingfisher, yes. So he said, well, I'll research it and so forth. Now, the story on Dana's story is Dana, and by his own admission, went to Naval Architectural School at MIT, but he and the academic side of naval architecture did not blend well, and he was, after a couple of years, was asked to leave. And so he left, and he eventually went in business for himself, and he built 7 or 8 vessels, 8 vessels, I believe, in the 1946 through 47 era. And one of the first vessels he built, as I speak here, is a vessel by the name of the Benjamin C., which is yours truly, Joey Chemetau's grandfather. Well, anyway, so he about a month later, he called me again, and he said, I've been to MIT, and Dana Story, even though he was asked to leave, had a passion for MIT in his late years, and he donated some pictures and diagrams and so forth of the Kingfisher. So I have an entire file on the Kingfisher, and I'm going to build it. So he did, and 6 or 8 months later, he called me again, and I went down to his studio in the shop in the Whistle Stop Mall in Rockport, and there was this beautiful model of the Kingfisher, and he he asked me some questions, and I was very familiar with the vessel. I put water aboard there as a 14-year-old boy, and you know, I knew a lot of about the nomenclature of the vessel and the power and the engine, the type of engine, and the deck equipment and so forth. So I was able to help him a little bit. And then he showed me a series of pictures, about 85, of every stage of the building of the Kingfisher in Essex, starting with the owner, Larry McEwing, and the ship builder, Dana Story, looking down on a architectural plan of the vessel, from the laying of the keel to the launching of the vessel to the vessel leaving on July 3rd, 1947, out of Gloucester Harbor on its maiden trip. So here he has a series of pictures, 8x10 glossies, and I'm just drooling over this whole thing. And I said, you know, Eric, if I could just copy those pictures, well, and somehow we get off the subject. About a week later, he called me. I come down, I have something for you. And he presented me with an album of the entire building of the Kingfisher. Oh. And I have that, and sometime I want that to be publicized. But anyway, so that's Eric Ronberg. That's what we were doing in those days. But I want to tell you that the workforce on the Gloucester Water, first of all, let's talk about who propelled this city. Who was the people that were the economic engine for the entire city? And I've got to tell you, there were wards 2 and 3. Maybe a few Gillnetters and so forth in East Gloucester. But 2 and 3 were the nucleus, the important segment. All of Portuguese, and I was corrected the other day by a Portuguese man, it's not Portuguese, all of the Portuguese population was located in Ward 2. That's my ward, where I grew up. Eastern Avenue to Perkins Street to Sadler Street to Webster Street to Friend Street to Elwell Street to Sadler Street, all that hill section, that was all Portuguese and primarily wharf workers that worked at this wharf, Captain Joe's Wharf. The Portuguese people, I can see them now coming down Fair Street, coming down Webster Street, walking through Cross Street, up the hill to get here to go to work and get home to get a sandwich. And as soon as they ate that sandwich, they were back down those roads, all to come back to work here. My uncle worked here, in fact, probably just down the wharf here on the nailing machine when I was a little kid. Anyway, there were a couple thousand people that supported this fishing fleet. 2,000. Figure it out. Wharf workers, machinists, shipbuilders, there were six railways in Gloucester that hauled vessels, 6 tracks. 3 railways, each had 2 tracks. Parkhurst over on the Harbor Loop, which is now the Coast Guard station, that was Parkhurst. Next door, of course, is the Heritage Center today, but it was the Gloucester Marine Railways, Burnham's Railways in the past, in my day. And then East Gloucester, Rocky Neck, was known as Chisholm's. And there was, as I say, 6 tracks, and they were always operating, always full of vessels. So we had 6 machine shops. We had 6 railways operating. We had 200-300 people working on the waterfront in miscellaneous trades, carpenter shops, Gorton's machine shops. Gorton's was a vertical company in those days. It's not a vertical company today. Gorton's built the vessels, they hired the fishermen, they bought the trips of fish, they processed the fish, they marketed the fish. That's called vertical. In 1954, there was a whole change. And in 1947, they built the largest vessel for themselves that they, in their entire history, a vessel called the Mother Ann. The intention was to build 2 more vessels similar to the Mother Ann to supply Gorton's of Gloucester with redfish during the redfish boom. After the Mother Ann was built, The other two vessels' orders were canceled. It was at that point in time, in 1947, that they were experiencing a different marketing experience. Now, that's an interesting story, because in the 1930s, our dory trawling business waned. It was on the way out because of the advent of the diesel engine, and I call that era our own Gloucester Industrial Revolution. Well, we transitioned from sailing vessels and salt fish to frozen fish, fresh fish, and diesel-powered vessels. That was a big transition. However, the cuttlefish products and the saltfish products that were manufactured did not just go away overnight. They continued on. How did they continue on? They continued on by Gardens of Gloucester buying the cuttlefish, processed salt cuttlefish from Nova Scotia, Lunenburg, Shelburne, not so much Lunenburg, Halifax, and so forth, and Newfoundland. That's where the cuttlefish, the saltfish cuttlefish came from, and they all came here in a fleet of vessels called the OK service boats. They were vessels approximately 100 feet in length, and they carried approximately 150,000, 200,000 pounds of salt fish, processed salt fish. At the potatoes, salt fish was combined with potatoes to make cuttlefish cakes, and it was canned in the local cannery. The building is still at the top of Union Hill today, the big building. That was Gordon's Cannery. Davis Brothers Cuttlefish Cannery was down where the Gloss House restaurant is today. But anyway, so Gordon's was experiencing this ability to process and manufacture cuttlefish cakes and those kind of saltfish products by buying the fish all processed from another country. I think that was the beginning of a change in how they were going to operate, because in 1954, the Mother Ann, the Edith and Lillian, the Benjamin C., the Mary and Josephine, and the Felicia, all left in 2 weeks for Newfoundland. They were sold outright. The Felicia and the Benjamin C. and the Mary and Josephine, your grandfather sold those boats. Right out from, it was a death knell for the city. We lost the biggest producers in the city of Gloucester to Newfoundland because the fish were, as Joey talked about it in the very beginning of the presentation, they were being fished out, and the fish were closer to Newfoundland than they were to Gloucester, and we were experiencing long trips, and that's another whole story. But getting back to Gordon's, Gordon's now was processing redfish. They still had a market for codfish, and that's how they satisfied it. Interestingly, in the potato season, the PEI, that's Prince Edward Island potato, was very popular, and those potatoes were also shipped to Gloucester in the OK service boats and taken out and put in the cold storage, which was across the street from Rose's Wharf today, and where the self-service gas station was, a big cold storage.
Oh,
there.
And right. Right, yeah.
And those potatoes were all stored in there. So, but Gordon's went from a vertical company to a horizontal operation. The vertical company also included the big machine shop that I talked about, the carpenter shop, the sheet metal shop. They had a dehydrating process company on their midst, and they also had a grocery store that fishermen, their wives could charge groceries while the boat was out, and then when they came in, the bill was taken right out of his share in the settlement office. So all those things went away, and now Gloucester fishermen, that you see the big sign, well, I often like to say that that fisherman has now comes to work in the morning in a hot shafter and max suit. He looks at a television screen or a computer screen all day long, and he buys codfish from Alaska, he buys haddock from Poland, He buys tuna fish from Brazil. He's all over the world. Everything comes to Gloucester in a trailer truck. It's all processed in one building. Goes in one end and comes out all packaged, and that's the whole Summit Substance. There's no, they market their fish, but they no longer go from A to Z. They just do one phase of the operation. So, what can I tell you? Is that good enough for one day?
Oh, it's fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic.
We're getting a lot of good feedback.
Yeah, the people, there's too many comments to even mention. If this is a great opportunity, if anybody has any questions for Ron, please just type them in right now because we're about to wrap things up. But these are great. Another segment we're going to do is the barroom, old barrooms of glass. We're not going to talk about
that. We can't do that today.
No. We're going to talk about that.
I have one question. When you were saying in the redfish, the byproducts, and everything that they were doing, and they were creating all these different things, yes, and they were shipping it out. What do you mean? Where did it go? All over the country? A certain area?
In the case of the byproducts, I worked at John Ryan's dehydrating process summer of 1951, and for the next five summers while I went to school in Boston, it was a seasonal operation. As I mentioned, there were three products, fish oil, fish solubles, and meal, fish meal, which is my department. But anyway, the oil was used in paint, in the manufacture of paint. The fish solubles was kind of like a soup, if you will. The fish were broken down in evaporators, which were vertical steam tanks and so forth, and it was kind of like a mush, if you will. Bones and everything became mush with water, and that was fed to farm animals as an additive to herd of cattle or pigs or whatever. And of course, the fish meal was an ingredient in fertilizer, and also was used, as I have been told, as an additive to chicken feed. So, well, it was a big business.
I can see it. So it's fun.
I'll tell you one little interesting story. You asked about the oil. We had a tank on the at the end of the fish pier. It's gone now, of course, but it's a big tank that held 10,000 gallons of fish oil, and it had a big pipe that came out of the bottom with a valve on it, and in fact two valves. And this tank was 10,000 gallons. Well, we were resting one day, and they wanted us to clean up the yard. We're raking up this and that, and an employee, he was operating the forklift truck, and got the forklift underneath the wire, the pipe, and don't you know, he snapped it off, and the oil, I can see the oil now blowing out of that tank for 10 feet out onto the well. The whole fish pier was covered with fish oil. And they had Hagstrom, the contractor, was down there with truckload after truckload of sand and gravel to absorb that mess.
People that have moved here in the past, 25, 30 years, and hadn't visited here prior, have no idea. What the stench from the dehyde gave in this entire area. I mean, it was a far-reaching stench that, like, if you see the area around, where Portuguese Hill, I guess you would say, or parts of East Gloucester, we see those houses are not necessarily like the fanciest houses in town, because it was an ungodly smell from the dehyde plant gave out. And another story was the harbor. What they did with the waste of this fish back then, that with the dumping into the harbor of the oils and the fish and stuff, there was there are people that tell me that lived on Rocky Neck that before they stopped using the dehyde and stuff like that, there was literally all the walls around the harbor were just covered and coated in gristle and
Joey.
Are we gonna talk like the Joe Gallen, or we gonna talk about realistic? Because you're the guy that's the realist guy. Hey, true or not?
Listen,
tell me, is that true or not? Are we gonna talk about how? Are we just gonna talk about Fantasyland?
You know,
was it true or not?
I don't. It wasn't see it
stinky.
That way.
It wasn't stinky back then.
I can tell you. Yeah, but hey, we weren't making roses down there. We were cooking fish.
I'll just say, yeah.
Right. We do have a question.
Manchester by the sea, Gloucester by the smell, correct?
There you go.
We do have a question from Rich Bean. Was fish oil used in the paint factory?
Was fish oil?
Used in the paint factory.
The manufacturer.
Not to my knowledge. The fish oil was, I worked there 5 years, and I never heard of any kind of consumption by a local paint factory.
Can you tell us, so in the, at the dehyde, what were some of the byproducts that were made from pogies? Because I know some of them were used in cosmetics, right?
Yes, yes.
What else?
And the fish scales, that was a big item. And I went pogie sailing, by the way, and... So we would pump out pogies, and the scales would come off. Well, the scales went one way, and so forth. And so anyway, and heron scales also. And the heron scales or pogie scales were saved in plastic. You've seen those plastic
bushel baskets?
Yes, bushel baskets.
Well, back then they were wire, but yeah.
And, in the case of St. Anthony, which I took my boys out on for all summer long and so forth, we would come in the morning, 15 to 20 bushel baskets of scales. Those scales were used in the jewelry business, I've understood.
They were iridescent. They had iridescent quality about
them. Yes, they
shiny
did.
Shiny quality.
And
what did they do with the oil that was pressed out of them? What was that used for?
That oil was used for the manufacture of paint, not in Gloucester, but that's what I've been told. Manufacture of paint and also some pharmaceutical applications to it also. But
about the mink food?
Well, now wait a minute. The mink food, that's a little different thing.
Okay.
And that's
let's get to it.
That's mink food. In fact, I'll give you an example. In 1946, the Melanson's Boatyard at the right across from the bank on Parker Street today, where it's a brand new complex, but there was a big building there and taken over by Herman Melanson, and right after the war, and he manufactured and built. Couple hundred lobster boats for the lobster boat industry, but he also built some smaller boats, inshore boats, one of which was a boat called the Minkette. The Minkette was a little side trawler, and it was built by a mink farm, and the whiting that it caught was used exclusively to feed their mink, whatever. And so whiting in not just the refuse, but the fish itself, raw fish, was used as mink food.
Wow.
Okay. Wow.
And there were other whiting draggers that that sold their product for that reason.
Yeah.
Any other questions you have?
I think we're good, Ron. I think we're good. I brought you some water. I don't even think you've tried it, but I could see you had a good run there.
Yeah, but listen, I want to, just as a preamble, when we get together sometime in the future, we're going to have a little discussion on the dens of iniquity that were.
That's what a lot of people. So we got a lot of comments. Tina Greel. A lot of these people are looking forward to hearing.
Who is it?
Tina Greel.
Tina Greel on Wise Place. Yes, I know Tina.
She's looking forward to hearing the stories about the old bar, dens of iniquity.
Maggie Wallace's Beck of the Blood.
I want to hear about the bands and stuff and how many times in the movie.
So we're not going to do
played.
That right now.
No,
but
no.
This is, we're just teasing. We're just teasing it right now. Yeah. So people can go, if you love Ron's stories, you can go to his blog.
You see, just briefly, the city of Gloucester was totally consumed with fishing. There were thousands of people that worked in the industry. They came mainly from Wards 2 and 3. That section, and it encompassed from the fort and Washington Square and Gould Court and Granite Street all the way to Eastern Avenue where I live. That area, those people, well, they worked 5 days a week, 5.5 days a week, mostly five, but they also worked nights. They worked hard. This business is a seasonal business. I don't care what you say, it's a seasonal business. It always has been. But I'll tell you, they get a year in a season, and they worked hard. Well, come Friday and Saturday nights, boom. We didn't have television. We had bowling alleys and other forms of recreation in the movie houses. But on a Friday or Saturday night, the town was wide open. They let their hair down, and those hard-working industry people were in every barroom in the city. And I know because I played in them in 1951, 52, and 53.
Yep. And we're going to talk about that in an upcoming episode. So if you love Ron's stories, he has a blog where he has detailed and has tremendous archive of photos, original photos that he has only access to. You can go to his blog, just go to your Google and type in The Gloucester I Love 2. The 2 is very important because that's the latest iteration of his blog. The Gloucester I Love 2. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Ron's going to be coming back. We're just going to keep on trying to add to his stories and keep them for generations going forward. We appreciate you being here, Ron.
Thanks to everybody. And people are being very complimentary. Gaetano says, great job, Ron.
Say that again.
Gaetano.
Frank Leone Jr.
Thank you. Says, great job. And David Jacobs says, well said, Ron.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
There you go.
I have a big Frank Leone story, by the way, for another day.
Yeah. No, we got plenty. And so stay tuned. Come back again and... Brenda Davis says, great podcast. Mm-hmm. So we're going to stop it right here. Thanks again. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, Pat, Jimmy, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ron.
Woo!